You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
All right, thanks so much for coming. I'm Sean Garrett of 463 Communications, I am a partner in our San Francisco office, which means when I come here, I get about, well, pretty much 100% more comments on the fact that I'm wearing jeans in D.C. than I will in an entire year in San Francisco. We're here to talk about the very broad topic of social media, its influence, where it's going, how it's having an impact on policy, tech policy specifically, how we're seeing influence change as different people use it and get engaged, how we're seeing industries change, like the media, traditional media industry, and then also how we're seeing just governments interact, use it, and get engaged with their constituency. And I think we've got a great panel that can cover all these topics. And so what I'm going to do is have each one of them give a less than 1 minute introduction of themselves and briefly talk about why they're here.
Great. Thank you. Stephen Van Rokel from the Federal Communications Commission. I've been at the FCC and a federal employee for about the last 7 months when I was appointed back in June as the managing director, which is effectively the chief operating officer of the agency. So beyond covering HR and finance and IT and everything else, I oversee our communications infrastructure, our new media outreach, the website. Don't take the existing website as an example of my work. We're working on that. And also I'm a tech advisor to our chairman. I spent 16 years before that on the West Coast working for a fairly large software company in the Pacific Northwest. And I am still getting used to wearing a suit every day. So.
Yep.
John Hinckley, the bio I prefer is I'm just this guy on the internet. I've been a blogger for many years, worked for a number of campaigns, worked in the Senate office of Senator McConnell, and have been doing public affairs work since then. Also run Arts and Labs, which is a technology policy coalition, and Digital Society, which is what I'll try to discuss later, what I'll call expert media or an online think tank.
Hi, I'm Kim Hart. Oh, wow, that was loud. I was with the Washington Post covering technology. I was a reporter and columnist there for about 3 years until about 6 months ago when I joined The Hill to start a technology policy blog there called Silicon Valley. Yes, it was my idea. I apologize for the cheesiness of it. I didn't think they'd take me seriously when I pitched it as an idea for the name for the blog. But so I have been kind of thrown into the world of blogging. It wasn't something I did a lot of at the Post, and now I'm constantly writing, I feel like. And if I don't have an internet connection, I feel like I'm about to die. I've also really been able to get much more involved in the social media scene. I'm in a place now where my editors are telling me to tweet more and asking me why I haven't tweeted today and things like that, which is a very big change from where I came from. So anyway, hopefully I can lend something to this panel.
I'm Jonah Seiger. I'm the founder and managing partner of Connections Media. We're an interactive agency here in Washington, D.C. And although I am in Washington, D.C., I, like Sean, am also wearing jeans. Connections Media is a full-service agency providing digital media strategy and technology services to corporate public affairs and political clients. I've been involved with internet and politics and campaigns for almost 16 years. Some of you in this room go back to the very beginning of the internet. We do a lot of work in relation to internet policy and many of the issues that have been discussed today in one way or another. I or members of my team have been working on, in particular, the open internet portfolio, which I think we'll probably touch on today. And most recently, we led the digital media efforts for Mayor Michael Bloomberg's reelection in New York City in 2009. So some interesting case studies on the use of social media and campaigns.
Jonah, let me start with you. As an old-timer like myself, you were there at the dawn of internet advocacy. In fact, you were involved with many of the campaigns that really represent the dawn of internet advocacy. Maybe you can remind some folks what those are. But, I don't want to deflate the social media thing as we get to start it, but I mean, isn't this just different tools, different tactics that people are using today? But really, what matters is the strategy, the messaging, the policies behind it. Just to say, if you're a member of Congress or whether you're a coalition, just starting off saying, "Hey, we need to get the Twitter. Let's get the Twitter and get it going, and then we'll be able to communicate." That's obviously, not the case.
You
saw how we went from websites to blogs to what we're now calling social media. What has changed? And essentially, am I right that they're merely just tactics?
I think that it's a little bit more complex than that. Mm-hmm. Just to give the little bit of the history, Sean's referring to some of the very first efforts to organize Internet users around issues relating to the Internet corresponded with the beginning of the Internet. So I was involved back in the days of the Clipper chip, the Communications Decency Act. For better or for worse, I'm the guy that turned the web black in 1996 to protest the CDA. I think that in one very basic way, the whole world has changed. There are now, hundreds of millions of people more on the Internet than there mm-hmm. were back in 1995 when we were mm-hmm. organizing against the CDA. There were just a few thousand websites. The reason why we could turn the web black was because Netscape instituted the ability to change the background color. Before that, every web page was gray. So in the sense that the penetration and the accessibility and the understanding has obviously increased in the last 15 years, I think that's a major change. But to a large extent, Sean is absolutely correct. The Internet enables a focusing and a channeling of attention on specific issues. And we see example after example after example. Today, the SOTN hashtag on Twitter is tearing up over Kim's coverage of the open Internet net neutralitini that we're all going to get to experiment with after this panel. Obviously, the attention is on Apple today. Tonight is the State of the Union. There is an ability to focus attention and channel people's emotion that the Internet enables. But it's true that we have the same conversation over and over again for the last 15 years, the certain notion of if you build it, they will come. If you're on Twitter, you've done the checkbox. Effective communication online is about listening as much as talking. It's about message more than technology. It's about being offering something substantive for people to engage with at the right moment where they can feel like they are empowered and that channeling that emotion can make a difference. So if that's a kind of a long answer to your question, everything is different, but many things are still the same. If you don't have a compelling message, all the technology and all the tactics in the world aren't going to make any difference.
Anyone else want to jump in on that?
I think another inflection point we're seeing now where it's not just the digitization of communications, which would be sort of the natural trend I think you'd see in government citizen interaction. It's really about the inflection of participation in organization, where I think we are at a point now, if you look at all the crowdsourcing tools coming online and all this, where citizens can actually play a role in participating in their government in a way we haven't been able to in the past. I mean, early examples like Fix My Street in the UK and other things like that, where I can go in and tell the local government, I've got a pothole here, I've got a problem here, is one example. Some of the regulatory agencies in the U.S. government are starting to now bridge into taking citizen input and actually putting that into the rulemaking process. So we're actually getting and scaling input where you don't have to hire a lawyer to do that, mm-hmm. so you can get that. And then organizing is the other side. I think we saw this in a grand scale in the last election cycle, but I think we've seen earlier ones where I can get my friends together, I can get a group together, and we can actually go out and really make a movement happen through organizing.
So, Lucien, let's just stick on you for a second. How did the FCC's social media effort come about? I mean, you obviously have a big job there. It's not, you don't spend all your day doing social media stuff. You're doing many more things. but you're also the guy who's talking about social media. I find that, one, I find that interesting. Maybe that speaks to the fact that you guys have to wear a lot of hats, or maybe it speaks to the fact that you guys just find it super important and strategic. I'd be curious your take on that. But how did it come about? What have you found in the FCC's process of getting engaged? You know, FCC, I think, as far as I know, is like the number third most followed government agency on Twitter, if I'm correct. What have you learned, and what have been some of the bumps along the road?
Well, there's a great irony in the fact that we're called the Federal Communications Commission when we probably had some of the worst communications of any government agency. And I think, you know, getting in, the reason, you know, I'm the number three person in the agency. Mm-hmm. And by having, you know, a mandate at the top of the agency driving new media has been, I think, a very successful thing. And a lot of other agencies, you'll see them put just one person on new media and kind of struggle to get things going. The magic sauce for the FCC was, one, we had a chairman come in to this agency who is very well known in the community, made his name in large part through the Obama campaign, driving a lot of the new media efforts there and strategy and tech policy. So we had that, you know, coming in, and he brought me on board. Two was, and this is sort of the secret weapon within the FCC, and I think a lot of government people overlook this, is our general counsel's office. Mm-hmm. Getting a lawyer who is dedicated to really being forward-thinking and thinking through how do we quickly work through terms of service and other things with vendors to make sure we can lower barricades. I mean, on the rulemaking aspect, the Administrative Procedures Act actually gives you a lot of flexibility, and if you apply a Web 2.0 lens to that, that actually can open up a lot of doors for you to allow citizen participation and involvement in things. So we wouldn't have been there unless we really had our general counsel working on our behalf and kind of fighting the battles and thinking through the tough problems and doing all that. And then I think the other part of it was just hiring a great team and getting people who, you know, have some experience, have some ambition, and really want to drive the process. And that was key for us. And we really went from zero. The current FCC website was developed in 1995-6. It won an award for the best government website in 1998 and didn't change after that. So I think so proud. That plaque is hanging in our hallways, actually, still. So we're going to – Kevin Werbach, if any of you know Kevin in this community, developed that website, and we're in the process of changing that over now. So.
Cool. John, you want to jump in?
Yeah, he makes a really good point, which I think is crucial. I worked in the Senate. I've seen it there. I've seen it from a distance in many – places. This is not just true of government, it's actually true of many organizations. And I will tell, and I've told many politicians, most of you probably should not blog because, and I mean no offense by this, politicians tend to be professionally uninteresting. Because if they are interesting, they make the front page of the Washington Post in ways that they don't necessarily like. So it is often best to have people who are not the leadership, people who are part of the team, people who are working on the details communicating. And that gets to a lot of the real problem. The barrier to a lot of social media is not technology. I mean, the technology is easy. The technology is a commodity to do this stuff. The barrier is generally integration with the entire team. It's not just having a separate e-campaign department or a separate social media person, as you said. It's not about having one person who does that. It's about having everybody across the team, or at least every department, capable of doing some of these things. One of the smartest things that I certainly can't claim credit for, but one of the smartest things I've heard is one fellow leader told his team, look, social media, I can provide you with the media, but I can't make you be social. And I think that's very, very true, especially in bureaucracies. If they are not willing to change the way they communicate or the way they think about moving information around, the nicest WordPress installation and Twitter account is not going to help you at all.
Can I add a point to that?
I think John is absolutely right. The thing I would add to that is that, besides the feedback, is that effective social media requires a sustained effort and a sustained commitment and a willingness to be more open and, frankly, to make mistakes. You have to listen as much as talk, and you have to engage with an audience in order to get back. I think that one simple way of describing social media is you get as much as you give. And that can be very, very challenging for any organization, but particularly the kinds of clients that we work with. As John said, if a politician is saying something interesting, they might be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or The Hill or The New York Times. And so finding that balance and that sustained commitment and the willingness to plow through when things don't go right sometimes is lost on organizations. They would like to just get there and be running full speed right away, and it doesn't exactly work that way. At the same time, if you're willing to put in the time and invest, the ability to grow a committed constituency that can be leveraged, the reach that you can get in social media is tremendous, and I can give you some insight on that a little later if we want to talk about it. But it requires patience and a willingness to take some risks.
So, Kim, you know, as members of Congress and of other folks in D.C. in the tech policy world get more engaged in social media and do this, they're obviously doing it to reach broad constituencies, not just reporters such as yourself. How has that impacted the way you cover these guys? Are you actually finding the transparency that's inherent in social media that allows you to get more information that benefits you, or are you also finding a double-edged sword, which is, you know, no longer is it just a kind of a one-way conversation with you and other folks in the media, where you have access to the information and then can distribute it out? How has that changed just in the last 5 years?
It's changed enormously even over the past year, I would say. At The Hill, we have the Twitter Room blog, which basically we have someone who's – it's half his job, but he spends a lot of time doing it – basically just trolling through Twitter and reposting all of the tweets from members of Congress. And it's amazing how much traffic that blog gets, because – people want to know what people are members are tweeting, but don't necessarily want to, you know, have it in their own stream or want to be bombarded with it all day. And I was really surprised when I got to The Hill at how much effort they were putting into following members on social media and how well received that was being by readers as well. For my own personal reporting, I have found that Twitter has become a source of story ideas for me. I used to use it really only to find examples of people or asking a question, just kind of throwing a question out into the ether and saying, who is having this problem, or has anyone noticed this, or what do you think about this, more when I was covering more consumer-oriented issues. But especially now, and the FCC is a great example of this, now that you guys are tweeting more and are, you know, just throwing out your releases out there, letting people know what's going on, I don't necessarily have to be glued to my email because I see that stuff come through regardless. So I think that's been really important. And also, I was at the October FCC meeting, actually, which was probably the most well-attended meeting because they were voting on the net neutrality NPRM. Someone made a comment to me it was a blogger who turned to me after the meeting and said, "Do you know who did the best job live blogging this hearing or this meeting?" And I said, "No, who?" And he said, "The FCC." And that's a change, a huge change from the past when the last thing the FCC wanted to do was have any more coverage than it had. So, yeah, I think it's changed drastically. I think that, as Jonas said, you know, it's a tool for listening more than talking. I think that's how I use it mostly, and I know, and John has told me on a couple of occasions that I need to do more talking and tweet more. I think his first email to me ever was, the first line was, "You need to tweet more now, no excuses, tweet more." And I do realize that I need to be out there more to kind of connect with my constituencies and even my sources. But the fact that my sources are out there is half the battle for me, I think.
And how's that different?
I wasn't trying to berate her. I was encouraging her because I like her.
Kim, I mean, you know, since you are out there and you have a a specific job that really almost, you know, really requires you to do this, but how, you know, and I mean, there's obviously folks at the Post who are savvy in this, but how does that change the dynamic over reporters who aren't even on Twitter, who are, you know, but are covering the space and, you know, have long-time relationships, and I'm not disparaging anyone, it's just a different style. Mm-hmm. But how does that create a different dynamic? And obviously at the FCC, you're dealing with two types of reporters too, and John and Jonah, when you're in your efforts, you're dealing with multiple, you know, folks who with multiple inputs. I mean, how do you think that changes it?
I'm not real sure. I'm not sure how it changes it for others. Mm-hmm. I do know. I mean, people who are covering.
Are we? There's like a digital divide being created in Washington, D.C.
There almost is. I think that with in the tech policy world, we're more prone to be on these tools because that's our job. We are just inherently more tech savvy than I think someone who's covering education policy or the budget. And so I think that in a way, as a tech policy reporter, I feel like I have a responsibility to be there because that's my job, is to know what people in the government are doing on these spaces. But there are plenty of people in my office who have never tweeted, who have an account and have never tweeted once, and I have told them not to do that. But, they cover budget and they cover other things that don't necessarily, they don't feel the need to do that.
So I guess, is tech policy kind of the canary in the coal mine when it comes to how other industries are going to do this within this world? Or are we just merely so obsessed with technology and live in it every day that we're always going to be different?
I think at least for the next year, we're probably going to be clearly the early adopters, and we're going to stay the early adopters, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure that that's entirely true, although I do think that the tech policy world, all of us in this room and in our community, are a little bit farther ahead. We certainly see it in the political media, there's a lot of experimentation and things happening. And I think you're starting to see it in some of the big consumer brands, some of the automobile industries, auto companies are out there. Starbucks has got the most followers on Facebook of any corporate entity out there. So we are all very special, but we are not unique here.
John, you work with some companies that you wouldn't say are, they're in the media space, right? But they're not technology companies per se, right? And, maybe you could talk a little bit about Arts and Labs and, one, what it is, what are you doing, and how you've kind of created a voice for this, or, basically a thought piece for this group of companies that have come together for various issues.
So Arts and Labs is a technology policy coalition of technology, entertainment, content companies. And if I say much more, I'll probably have to file an ex parte. As I was working on this and looking at this, I eventually realized that there's a problem in this space, and that is a difficulty of large organizations to communicate. It's very, very difficult to talk because you've got very, very different, and it gets back to the point I made earlier, you've got very different cultures about what these organizations are used to doing. And let's face it, at the end of the day, you've all heard of the term path dependency. Well, if you have risen to the level of communications director, whether it's in a policy department or just corporate or marketing or wherever, if you've risen to the level of communications director, your specialty, what your path dependent on, is probably relationships with reporters at New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, The Hill, organizations like that. And so that's where you put your information. That's where you take things. So I like to describe this as a supply and demand problem. We clearly don't have a problem with demand for information. Millions of people want information, whether it's whether it's grassroots all across America or just a few people in the FCC who are looking for information. When I was on the Hill, the staffers, when they're not directly doing a project, they were reading blogs. And when they were doing a project, the first thing they did was check the blogs to see if there was any useful information they could glean from there before going elsewhere. So there's lots of demand for information. There's also lots of supply of information. I mean, everybody has information. Everybody in this room, every organization, every agency, every official, everybody has information that they want to communicate to people. The problem we have is middlemen. We've got these path dependencies. In years past, the gatekeepers, I hesitate to use the word gatekeepers, but the power law dictated that there were just a few people that really we went to get information or to move information. But as we're getting so much more diverse media, so many more media organizations, I mean, I think premier examples of that, especially in the technology space, are things like GigaOM and TechCrunch and Wired and Ars Technica and places like that they're terrific, but they're not traditional media. These are very new forms of media. So now the gatekeepers or the filters, the traditional middlemen, have been, I won't say marginalized because don't get me wrong, if you never get the Wall Street Journal, that's terrific, and that wouldn't get in the way of that. But there are a lot of other places. And if you have information, you know that maybe 10% of that information actually gets conveyed. Most of the information, you're just never really able to communicate effectively. So now there are, instead of if you have 100 units of information and you move 10 units of that, now you're sitting on 90 units. And traditionally, because of the past dependencies of the people who do it, you just don't move that information. You are not able to communicate that. Well, now there are thousands and thousands of new ways, new channels to communicate information. And so often, some of the information that really has an impact doesn't come from the traditional channels. The White House changed their privacy policy, some of their privacy policies on the website because of things that were happening in the blogs. I've seen Levin at the FCC talk about things that he read on the blog. So there are many different ways to communicate now. And so a lot of what we're looking at is, you know, how can we move the rest of the information? Because there's a lot of other things we want to say. And now there are thousands of new channels.
Well, and what, you know, I noticed that you didn't really get into Artisan Labs that much, but I think one thing I've noticed about that model is that you obviously have, and it's the same thing with like the Open Internet Coalition, or where is you have a group of companies with a specific perspective that's putting out its own content. It's putting out its own perspective. And I think Artisan Labs and some of the other folks are doing it, I think, to your credit, John, are doing it in a way that is generally fairly thoughtful. It's not didactic. It's, you know, it's not attack. It's more pure some thinking on this issue and some thoughts on it, though I noticed you hired Andrew Keen recently, so that may all change. Look up Andrew Keen if you need to. But what I'm noticing now is almost a kind of post-neutral media world where no one really, you know, we lived for so long where the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, had lived by specific journalistic codes. You know, we've now, several years into social media and blogs, et cetera, have almost gotten to a point where we just have this ongoing massive conversation happening online. And as long as you're interesting and can provide good points, it doesn't really matter essentially who's paying you and why. Of course, that will come up, and you always will be colored with it. But if you read these blogs, as you mentioned, TechCrunch, Gigaom, et cetera, that are very influential in the space, and even as you read, you know, it bubbles up into the New York Times and into the Wall Street Journal, a lot of what people are saying are coming from advocacy organizations, from the left, from the right, or coming from, you know, just merely the FCC's putting it out there and getting involved in the conversation themselves. Are you guys seeing this, Kim? Is this something that, you know, how does this affect the journalism world? Is this post-neutral thing actually happening?
In a lot of places I think it is. I think that it's still a struggle. It's a fine line that all journalists have to walk, and they have to kind of make that decision, okay, especially for those of us who kind of cross the line into the blogosphere, what kind of blogger are you going to be? Are you going to take a side and have an opinion and have a stance, or are you going to try to kind of carry the same objective values from the traditional news media over into the blogosphere? And there are people out there who would argue that objectivity is kind of a false idea anyway, and that never really existed, yeah. It's impossible to not let your bias come into your work. But I think, while I see that point, I think even though that I am a blogger, I think I still try to be as fair as I can. I will write from as many points of view as I possibly can, and I actually really kind of pride myself in that people don't really know where I stand and which side of the aisle I fall. Because I think that's, at the end of the day, people will be able to kind of trust my judgment a little better in that situation. Other bloggers have decided that they're going to not do that, and I think that offers a very valuable commodity as well. That's something that people look to and that they need, especially, you know, even at Ars Technica and GigaOM and some of the other really great blogs out there. It's still evolving for me, too. I think I'm still trying to find that sweet spot. I've only been blogging for about 4 months now, and so I'm still kind of getting used to the model. And one thing I just wanted to follow up on something that Jonah said in terms of, you know, the fact that car companies and Starbucks and all of these big companies are going to the web and they have blogs, they're on Twitter. I think that just because, from the media point of view, just because these big companies and organizations or coalitions are online, that doesn't necessarily mean that the media knows that they're online or are following them en masse to a point where that can be their main way of pushing out information. I think that
and just touching back on the digital divide issue that you brought up, Sean, that a lot of it is a bit of a generational divide, too, that as journalists come in, I think a lot of journalists out there, because there are fewer opportunities at newspapers, there are fewer ways that they are kind of, I don't want to say indoctrinated or anything, but trained in that way, that there are more people who are going to take kind of a personal view of blogging and that they're going to take to social media much more quickly, and that's going to be a huge source of ideas and, pushing out ideas as well. So I think that as the press corps kind of takes a different demographic look, that might change things as well.
Speaking of blogging, I was just, as you were talking, Kim, I was thinking about 2 or 3 years ago, the blogging was all of the rage, right? We all were talking about blogging. Today it's social media, microblogging like Twitter, Connection.
Twitter's an information network.
I'm sorry?
I said Twitter's an information network. It's not.
I think of it more as a broadcast medium, but I guess I should be schooled by Sean. And Facebook is about as much about connections as anything. I think that what we're seeing is an evolution of ways of drawing attention and finding information. When you think about what's the influence of a blogger, it's their credibility on the subject matter, how fair and balanced they seem to be or not. I mean, some blogs thrive because they're distinctly not balanced. But in this, with billions of blogs out there, how does anybody find you and make sense of knowing you? That's where I think this layer of social media is coming in. And in that sense, we think about it from the standpoint of influence. And to me, influence is derived from one of two things, either the strength of the reach of someone who's speaking. When Jack Dorsey, one of the founders of Twitter, tweets about things that Mike Bloomberg is doing in the campaign and has 1.5 million followers, I can see immediately response to that. Our followers increase, our traffic to that link is larger than other links. I can feel viscerally that impact. But just as much as one or two or five individuals with large numbers of followers or friends on Facebook, the long tail effect, the large volume of relatively small constituencies that are retweeting or reposting information drives a lot of traffic. So I think that there's more to it, I guess, than what we're talking about. I see social media as a means to listen and to engage and to spread. And you want to try to find those people that are have affinity to your subject matter, who are influential, or find large numbers of people who are not as influential, who can create volume and drive awareness of a particular resource. The bottom line is this: if you're an advocacy organization or trying to communicate from an organization, you should never tweet, or you should almost never tweet or post on Facebook anything that doesn't have a link, because otherwise you have no way of understanding what you're getting back from that. You're just sort of screaming into a dark room.
Yeah, there's like an experiment that's going to go on in France in a couple of weeks, where these five journalists from all French-speaking countries are going to sit in a room and basically get information from Facebook and Twitter for 5 days, but they're not allowed to use.
They're allowed to eat?
They're allowed to eat, not allowed to use the phone, not allowed to look at watch TV.
Can we send them some net neutralitinis?
Yes, just Twitter and Facebook, but they're not allowed to look at the web in general, so they can't click on any links. It just kind of defeats the purpose. Questions, feel free to jump up. Also, my Twitter username is @SGSG, so if you want questions that way, that's cool too.
I'd like to expand on this point on listening and kind of, I think I mentioned it earlier, and I think it's a profound, profound thing we're starting to see, is the involvement of community, the involvement of citizens in their government. I mean, the Administrative Procedures Act, which basically rules and regulates the creation of policy in this country, has a great word in it. It says that these agencies must gather feedback from the public to enlighten decisions that are made. And I love the word enlighten from the standpoint that there's a direct great translation to Web 2.0 technologies. Mm-hmm. We launched openinternet.gov with the net neutrality proceeding, and it was maybe 6-8 weeks ago, and we've received over 120,000 comments in from citizens that directly go into the public record, and never before have we had those sort of conduits. We would get, you know, thousands of comments, maybe on a really very you know substantive type ruling in the agency, but those were all flowing through just one channel. Those people who could afford to hire a lawyer and basically, you know, come and input those comments. And so I think starting to look at how rules in this country are really shaped, you know, by the citizens for the citizens of this country is a thing we're going to see more and more of as we move forward.
So at what point will people be able to use Facebook or Twitter or other mediums to actually provide comment?
I think in the next 18 months you'll probably see a lot of federal agencies dialing this up. Today, if you go to, you know, our broadband.gov website on the National Broadband Plan and you comment on our blog, it goes into the official record. A lot of people don't know that. On open internet, we use a crowdsourcing platform, IdeaScale, and if you enter a comment on IdeaScale, you vote it up, you vote it down, that actually gets entered into the public record, and the rulemakers inside the agency actually will look at that, and we're looking at, you know, how do we do high text or high volume text analysis, because careful what you wish for when you get lots and lots of comments coming in, and I think it is enlightening the direction, and we're heading on a lot of these things. It's bringing up a lot of substantive issues that we can then respond to in the public. It's giving us good insights into how to shape these rules and
how do you actually like take the comments? I mean, is it fairly real time, or like when suddenly you see one day, you know, 200 comments about a specific issue, you must go, oh geez, this one issue is really you know bouncing around? Or do you guys wait at the end of the week and Fridays you pour through the comments and you select out what you think the most relevant are, and you know, should we consider, should we think about it? How does that actually work on the back end?
So two ways. Yep. One is we pretty much every day are mm-hmm. watching and mm-hmm. looking and seeing if there's things that are coming up on a pretty regular basis. And tend to look at, you know, how do we respond to those? Do we need to do a public workshop to, you know, engage citizens on substantive issue maybe we hadn't considered? Two is we're looking at and working with some universities on high-volume text analysis to mm-hmm. say, you know, of 120,000 comments, how can we run a software algorithm against that to really pull out commonality amongst those things? In the open internet proceeding, about 3,000 of the 120,000 were sort of what I consider mass mailing type things. So we give those 3,000 credit for 3,000 entries, but, you know, we don't have to read every single one of them. Software can actually tell us that that's just one comment that's been mailed to us over and over again or input into the system. And so so this software will, you know, at the end of the day, I think when we reach the end point of making this all work, we'll really put topic areas in different folders and allow people to go in and actually kind of have a human level of interaction to be able to digest that volume of information. So.
Cool. Hi, I have a question for the panel. I'm Angela Maycock. I'm from the American Library Association. So I represent maybe the traditional gatekeepers of information that John mentioned earlier. But I was really interested in Sean's comment about this sort of post-neutral media world that we're in. And when we're talking about social media, I think we need to think about the idea of customized content and that we're not just communicating, but we're listening. But my concern is, are we listening in an echo chamber? Mm-hmm. Are we customizing our content to the point where we're not hearing opposing viewpoints? And one of the things that libraries pride ourselves on is that we're a cornerstone of democracy because citizens can get educated across a spectrum of ideas. So my question, I guess, for the panel is, what do you see in your experience using social media as far as civic engagement and participation? Are you seeing that polarized discourse, and what implications do you think that might have?
Jonah?
Just because I inhaled. I think that there is truth to that. It's a topic that we in this community have been talking about long before Twitter or Facebook. We do tend to want to hear and see and consume information that reinforces our expectations. I don't watch Lost because I'm not interested in it. I loved Battlestar Galactica. You might have a very different view. At the same time, I think what social media is bringing, particularly Facebook and Twitter, is that it's about connections that exist in the real world as much as the virtual world. And I think it does create opportunities to be influenced by other points of view. People who might not post, and by the way, I have some swag here for our Open Internet Open Internet Now campaign. This is one example. The Bloomberg campaign is another example. People who log in, use Facebook Connect, or log in with a Twitter credential and tweet out a message about supporting the open internet, or I'm voting for Mike Bloomberg, you should too, might be exposing their friends, their families, to a message that they wouldn't otherwise be aware of. Some of those people may not like that, but I do think that what we're seeing in social media is that a little bit of breaking down of that, that there are more opportunities for people to be exposed to other viewpoints. Now, the other fact of the matter is that people tend to be friends with people who are like-minded. So there is a certain limitation to this fact. But I'm encouraged and hopeful, and I think that's where one of the powers of social media is, because content is coming in the form of really a personal endorsement. It does create opportunities for people connected to each other to be exposed to different points of view.
It's funny. There was like that analysis tool that you had on Facebook last year, or it was during the election, where you'll see what the Republican or Democratic affiliations were of your friends, and it looked at all my friends and myself, and it was all 90% Democrat.
And you're a Republican,
even though I'm a reformed Republican, but then just in the last couple of weeks, I noticed on Twitter all these people tweeting about Scott Brown and the Massachusetts election and go Scott go and yada, yada, yada. And I mean, I'm in California, and I'm barely paying attention to this, but I know it's important. And, if it literally were not for Twitter and these people who I follow, I probably would not have learned about Scott Brown, the election, although I probably should have. I'm busy, and that was my filter, and so that opened my eyes to it. I also think, to Kim's point earlier, that there might be a little bit of a generational divide here in how people filter different opinions, or at least I'm hopeful that there is. I don't want to cast any aspersions on folks, but I generally see people. I saw during the presidential campaign, people in older demographics taking stuff on the internet super literally, and they were the people who were talking about Obama being an antichrist, et cetera, because they saw it on YouTube. And I'm not. This is a breakfast conversation I had with my mother-in-law, in North Texas. And it's true, it's real. We all knew that was out there. And it's so easy for us, the educated, to go, hush, that's so stupid. Why would anyone ever think that? But that was a big deal. There are also a lot of people like my dad and others who forward me, these crazy emails that you have to, continually send them back to Snopes on. You don't see many 25-year-olds doing that. They don't come from my younger brothers who are in their 20s. I think maybe just the way people's brains work and the way people take in information, hopefully people will start to filter and be able to say, they could process so much more. And hopefully that's a good thing. Any other perspectives on that?
Yeah, I would say two things. One, the people being wrong on the internet is not a new phenomenon. And it's not something we need to get that worked up about. No. People are wrong when they're not on the internet, too. It's always been there. It's just much, much more visible. It's like the media in 2001 was talking about shark attacks. Well, there weren't actually more shark attacks in 2001. They were just talking about it, so we were more aware of it. The same thing applies. But to your point, they actually have done some research about whether the internet increases polarization and people do wall themselves off in echo chambers. And while there's some truth to that, I guess, on the margins, but in general, that hasn't been true. People are exposed to exponentially more information than they agree with, but they're also exposed to exponentially more information they disagree with. I would say that the internet allows us to be better specialists. If you want to learn more about library issues, you can learn way more now on a very, very granular daily basis. But you can also learn much, much more about everything else, too. And I think we're seeing probably both.
So the question is, you can, but do people do it? Do people do it enough? And I'm just playing devil's advocate. Because you may just end up in a library bubble and never leave it. Just as, in Silicon Valley, there are people who read 3 blogs a day and listen to a guy named Robert Scoble and Michael Arrington, et cetera, and that's their only source of information. Whatever these guys say is the word, and they think of themselves as really evolved people because they're tech savvy, but they're not. They just listen to 3 people.
I don't see how that's any different than it was, 30 years ago when people would only read National Review or The Nation, or they'd only read... We've always had the ability to sort of cocoon ourselves with that information that we want. We just have a lot more information now.
Any other opinions?
Can I
on
just
this?
Add one thing, addressing your question in a slightly different way? I think that from the editorial perspective, I think you have a real point about the kind of echo chamber and the bubble situation, especially when it comes to political reporting. I've noticed that now in a world where media is newspapers are moving online, and that the holy grail is web traffic and hits, not necessarily circulation readers. In the traditional sense, that if one of my stories gets picked up by the Drudge Report, for example, it can crash our servers because we have so many hits. And then that's great for me, but does that mean that I tailor everything I write for the Drudge Report so that I have a better way of getting more traffic? That's a real debate, I think, right now among reporters and editors, just in how do we maintain the integrity of what we're covering and cover the things that aren't necessarily sexy and aren't going to ruffle some feathers. Does that mean that we ignore that and only go for the kind of sensational things?
And I think on the public participation standpoint, the two challenges we have there is really one is qualified participants mm-hmm. in the public dialogue. So if you're doing say you're doing a regulatory proceeding for the hearing impaired, how do you reach the hearing impaired to actually give you input? One of my big fears when we went down a participation road at the FCC was that ham radio operators would be setting the policies for all the entire country. And then, our first blog reply on our reboot post was from a ham radio operator, which I thought was kind of telling. But we're working on that. So kind of getting that qualified participant to come to you and be involved is part of the challenge. And I think the other side of that is access to technology, access to information, access to the web. There's still a large percentage of this country that either views their, internet on a little screen like this, or not at all. And thanks in large part to the libraries in this country, lots of citizens have access to broadband and web content there. But still, there is a divide that I think is happening on the if this is the avenue of social media is the avenue in which we communicate to our citizens. Those without that access are going to be really limited. And so how do we bridge that? We've launched some mobile efforts to do some things to make it very easy to participate. And I think attaching, your strategy for those in the audience that are in an agency or in government, attaching to known social media entities, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, are going to open doors for you for participation because you can then these people can easily download apps, phones are coming with it all built in, and you can really connect to people that way. So it's a nice bridge.
Notwithstanding the digital divide point that you made, I actually do think it's never been easier to identify those constituencies. The power and granular targeting of search, particularly both organic and paid search, hashtags, influencers on Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms, you could find the hearing impaired community, for your example, much easier today than you could 4 or 5 years ago.
Totally agree.
And so I think that is very promising, and yet you still do have to confront the fact that, well, most of America is online, not everybody is.
Question?
Sure. My name's Alex Howard. I write for searchcompliance.com and on Twitter under Digifile. I asked you a question a bit earlier. It's interesting to see how the FCC has, instead of rebooting its website, although you've got reboot.fcc.gov now, reached out towards other technology platforms to solicit feedback, IdeaScale being one of the big ones. I guess the concern to the librarian's point is in all of these new platforms, if there is a means for people to still use them and yet retain their privacy when it's around a more sensitive issue, and if it's possible for reporters to use them and yet still retain that objectivity or illusion of it, because I think nearly anyone has bias. And I can tell you from having covered big tech companies that after I write about them, they watch, and then other companies watch, and they see whether I'm covering them not or not or how they're covering them, and it's very easy for them to pull all the data out of social media and see exactly who I talk to, when, where, and how. And when you get into the thornier issues around net neutrality or around other more contentious tech areas around access, how do you guarantee that constituents are able to voice subjective opinions in a private way? Do you have any thoughts on these things?
Can you expand?
Yeah, what do you mean by private way?
Having
worked on the Hill, you send a letter, you usually put an address. If you don't, you're not going to get a reply.
Well, I guess I'm having visited D.C. a couple times, worked here for a little while, it still seems like a discussion with lobbyists in person is a much more powerful thing than an aggregate number of tweets that went trending one day, right? You can embarrass a clothing company that's throwing out torn garments on the streets of New York, but it's much harder to embarrass a government agency into actually changing its policy. And since this panel is about tech policy and social media, I'm wondering whether you can think of examples of places where these platforms are actually changing government policy at the highest level. Whether they're going to pay attention to people online, you know, is a question from Google moderator on YouTube actually going to get asked to the president. Yeah. We know he's reading blogs now. He just, you know, got reported that he's out there reading Andrew Sullivan's tweets. But is that going to change policy?
Yeah, I think this time in our history with the connections we're making through social media are actually driving that in a much more profound way that didn't exist in the past. I think the power of that individual lobbyist having a one-on-one meeting with a regulator was a super powerful thing. But when you get 120,000 comments coming in, rulemakers in a federal agency will pay attention to that, and I think people have a much larger voice in this country and in the dialogue. And I think as we evolve this medium of using social media to actually drive and influence policy, that influence is actually going to grow and grow and get.
I guess to the question, which I think is a great one, is it just kind of like, I don't think anyone can question that it's going to grow in influence, but are we at an era right now where it's just like the PC thing for, members of Congress and the administration and others and agencies to say, hey, we're on Twitter, we're listening, we're engaged, but really, to the questioner's point, it's really all about that one-on-one relationship and, the meetings and, at restaurants at 10 o'clock at night, the way it used to be and maybe the way it still is. So if that is the case, will it change? Is it going to change? Are we seeing signs of that, or disagree that whether it's changed already?
I think that there's a distinction between governing, to your question, and politics. I think that the influence that we're seeing now is more on the political dimension. Scott Brown is a terrific example of that. What Scott Brown did successfully with social media was nationalize the race to bring money and volume. It's why Sean heard about it in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We did a lot with social media in the Bloomberg campaign that I think we can demonstrate made an ultimate difference in our margin of victory. We won by 50,000 votes. We know we reached way more people than that directly through social media. But that was about politics. That wasn't about governing. That was about election GOTV. For us, it wasn't about fundraising, but for Scott Brown, it was about fundraising. I think the success of the Obama campaign in 2008 is obviously the biggest story there. I think the jury is still out in terms of governing. I think what the FCC is doing is exemplary and should be used as a model for other agencies, and I know that other agencies are watching the FCC and trying to emulate the FCC. I can tell you that in New York City there is a very big effort towards openness, accessibility of data, modifying the city's services to enable better constituent services through technology. The best example of that actually is 311, which is an example for the nation. They continue to evolve that. You see a pothole in your neighborhood, they'll come fix it. Last week, they started accepting contributions to the Mayor's Fund for New York City for Haiti relief through 311. You could call 311 and make a contribution. So services, the services aspect of government being influenced by technology, I think is happening all over the country, and certainly the political dimension. But I'm not sure about the governance. It's much harder to parse through all that information and to make sense of the inputs that you get. So I think to your question, I think there are some distinctions that we have to get. We are going to struggle to get to the perfect place of how to listen and allow citizens to engage effectively through technology in the process of governance. Some of those questions go to the very heart of our democracy, too, by the way. But in terms of politics and in terms of services, government services, I think there's no question that what we're seeing in technology has had a tremendous and meaningful impact.
And the other point to make is that rules that are established in this country have to uphold, you know, the checks and balances against a rule is basically there is a legal check at the end where if we get feedback from the public, which in the previous sense meant a, you know, official filing against a rule in the Administrative Procedures Act, if we ignored that finding or if we ignored a piece of data that was subject or that was very material to the rule that was established, we could go to court and people could overturn the rule based on the fact that we ignored maybe an academic study or some analysis or something that was, you know, very material and substantive towards the rule. By opening this up in social networks, we really uncover that data. We give citizens of this country eyeballs against those checks and balances and really open the door for people to cry foul if we are ignoring something or we're not taking into account something that is material against the rule. That includes not only the social media input. We also put a basically indexed the entire history of comments done at the FCC. You can now do an instant search against any filing, any date, any docket within the past to say what did AT&T say about this rule? What did Comcast say about this rule? What did this company say about this rule? And get the official comments that were put in, the official ex parte forms that were filed for visits to the agency. Plus now you can now search all the social media stuff as well. And so really getting kind of a complete picture of the dialogue that happens around an issue. Now, it doesn't take away the one-on-one meetings, but it does, it does alleviate some of that in the new world.
Before we close out, Kim, did you have something to add?
I just had a question for Steve real quick. You're on so many social media platforms now. The FCC is your YouTube. You have a YouTube channel. You have a MySpace page. You're on Facebook. How do you, as we all know from reading comments online, for every legitimate comment or intelligent-sounding comment, there is a completely crazy person commenting as well and maybe saying completely inappropriate things, especially for a government-sponsored
site. That's not nice to say about Comcast.
I was going to say, watch out for the tweets from that person there listening to the webcast.
How does the FCC monitor that or deal with those people who are kind of who could be jamming up the dialogue with just reposting crazy things just because they can?
Yeah, it's not easy. You hire a great new media team, you bring them to conferences and let them eat free cookies. They're all sitting in the back of the room. It isn't easy. The first thing we really took a hard tack at was working with our general counsel to write a great moderation policy. And so working really hard to understand, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. The other thing that kind of is a gatekeeper for us is based on our legal interpretation, my team's legal interpretation of the Administrative Procedures Act, we do an email verifier for people that want their comments to go into the official record.
Okay.
So when you submit your to get your comment into the official record, you have to provide an email address. We mail you something. You click on a verifier, and then it then posts to the official record. We do that for legal reasons because if say an academic person posts the results of a study they did but doesn't link to the source, we have no way of contacting them, and there could be a legal challenge against those findings. And so we require that you do that email verifier. We keep it all, you know, private, never shared, et cetera, great privacy policy there. So that tends to weed out people that will, like, cloud the docket with erroneous things in large part. And so that helps to some extent. So I think the 1-2 combination of those and then just having a great team of people that are kind of just living the stuff and filtering it as much as possible.
All right.
Not for political voice, but just for against the moderation policy.
Let me add one thing, real quick. You want to go?
No, just real quick.
This is full circle because I talked about the same thing last year. I think we're only in a phase now, not a phase. I think this is a step where allowing a lot more people to talk to the FCC, yeah, that's great, that's valuable. I mean, I'm not sure how many times you need to see, you know, a page and a half about what time Howard Stern is on. I think you got one of those in your 120,000. But that's not the last step. I think the last step is not giving people more voice. More voice is not what we're all looking for in politics. What we're looking for is more choices. So if the internet just allows us to yell louder and talk more often, okay, it's been helpful, but that's not where we want to go. Where we want to go with this is the internet, through agencies, through, you know, dealings, whether it's the DMV or the FCC or the Department of Justice, wherever, is the internet giving people more choices in how they interact with their government, more choices in the solutions that are available to them, and more choices in policies as well that affect them personally.
On that upbeat note, go have some net neutralitinis or whatever they are, which is a slightly better name than the iPad. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.